TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ellen Brown, Bypassing Wall Street, a public bank for Mendocino County, one of the smaller counties of California, 100 miles north of San Francisco. From the Pacific Ocean to Freeway 101, has a reputation for creative local resistance. The first to pass an ordinance against genetically modified organisms, Mendocino now may become the first in the U.S. to stand up to Wall Street and set up a local public county bank. Unless, of course, the city of San Francisco, where plans are well developed to create such a bank, beats Mendocino to the punch. Such a public bank would be authorized to remove the county's funds from the commercial private bank that now manages the deposits. The county bank would be able to use the same credit system that private banks use, which means access to the current 0.25% interest rate instead of the going rate of 4 to 6% or more. Such a public bank would partner, not compete, with the local community banks and credit unions. A movement to create a county charter is already underway and should be placed on the ballot for the upcoming election. By California state law, a town or county needs to create its own charter in order to be allowed to set up its own bank. If all this sounds utopian, stay tuned to this broadcast, because one of the preeminent proponents of public banking, the lawyer and author Ellen Brown, will explain how this works. She's the president of the Public Banking Institute that keeps a highly informative website at publicbankinginstitute.org. Ellen Brown's best-known recent books are her analysis of the Federal Reserve, entitled The Web of Debt, and her 2013 book, The Public Bank Solution. Public banking, says Ellen Brown, is common across the world. Globally, 40% of banks are publicly owned. These are largely in the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. They all were much more resilient to the current credit crisis. Even though public banking has distant roots in the American Revolution, only one public bank, founded in 1919 in an act of popular resistance to Wall Street, exists and really flourishes in the U.S. today. It is the Bank of North Dakota, and Ellen Brown will include much of their history and inspiring current practice in her talk. Their website is banknd.nd.gov. There are pragmatic reasons as well for setting up a public bank. As we all know, banking reform has not ended profiteering or speculation. One result of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was that in the next crisis, the taxpayers will not foot the bill. Who then will pay next time was made clear when banks on the island of Cyprus failed and deposits of some of their customers were seized. The banking rules that apply to Cyprus apply to the U.S. as well, according to new law passed via handshake, not treaty, by the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, housed in Basel, Switzerland. In 2009, the G20 countries agreed to be regulated by the FSB. This bail-in protocol that allows deposits to be seized was established by the FSB in 2011. So the issue of public banking has two very urgent implications. On one hand, it holds the promise of having a money supply that can be interest-free and allows communities or even states, such as North Dakota, to set their own priorities. On the other hand, it helps to protect deposited funds from being seized in the next financial crisis. Here's Alan Brown, recorded in Willits, California, on December 14, 2013.
Well, it's great to have this opportunity to talk about public banking to a community that really is a community and that seems to be very interested in this idea and you might actually take it and run with it. I think you'd be the ideal template. California is always on the cutting edge, and particularly Northern California. And I've heard that there are a lot of sort of, you know, people that are really into sovereignty and making your own rules and doing your own thing. And for that, you need your own banking system, particularly when you understand how banking works and the fact that banks actually create all of our money, or virtually all of it. So I'm going to talk about state-owned banks and county-owned banks, but first I want to go into some basics of where money comes from in order to establish why you really want a bank, how they, Wall Street, have parasitized our economy, and how if we want to have a sustainable economy, we really have to be the bank. We have to generate our own credit, and that is something we can do publicly as a, you know, as a public institution. Okay, so where does money come from? Most people think it comes from governments because you see all the faces of the presidents and the queens and so forth on the paper bills. But in fact, coins make up a very small percentage of the money supply, and that is the only money that the U.S. Treasury actually issues. Even the paper dollar bills, which compose only a couple of percent of the money supply, are created by the Federal Reserve, which is not actually federal. It's composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. And it's not like they print the money and spend it, as a government would do. They print the money and lend it. So the government winds up borrowing the money just like everybody else. So the government is not the source. Our elected government is not the source of our money supply. And you can tell that by looking at this chart, which is a chart of the money supply. The blue line at the bottom is coins, dollar bills, and checkbook money all together. It's called base money, so it's the money created by the Fed and the Treasury. It's a relatively small percentage of the whole thing, and this only goes up to M2. M2 is basically the money that circulates in the economy that we deal with all the time. But it's really credit. So most of that is bank credit created by banks. And then M3 includes the repo market, the money markets, the shadow banking system that we don't really participate in, but it's a large part of the credit system. If you count M3, it goes up to something like $16 trillion. Then I won't try to get into that. So they will turn your IOU into something you can spend in the marketplace. And that's what our money is. Virtually all of our money is spendable IOUs. So it's just credit. And for that service, the bank charges interest. This shows the miracle of compound interest. It's a miracle if you're the lender, not so much if you're the borrower. So if you invested $10,000, say at age 20 when you started out your working career, and you just kept it invested at 6% compounded annually for your whole working life for the next 40 years, your $10,000 would become $100,000. So that's huge, but where did that $90,000 come from? That's all credit upon credit. Since virtually all of it is created by banks, there's no place to get that extra money except by more loans. So you wind up in this pyramid scheme where somebody continually has to be borrowing just to keep this pyramid scheme going. And that money is not coming back into the system. The banker does not return the money to the system, as a public bank would. But typically, your Wall Street bank is siphoning it off into offshore tax havens. There's now between $21 and $32 trillion in offshore tax havens, most of which emanates from Wall Street. So that works until the parasite runs out of its food source, and then it collapses. And so that's where we were, for example, in 2008. Periodically, it hits the wall like that and collapses. So when that happened in 2008, the government bailed them out, and around the world, governments bailed out their big banks. But the governments are getting, that we, the taxpayers, are objecting to that. And so in the Dodd-Frank bill, it says the next time, what they should have done in Dodd-Frank was to reimpose Glass-Steagall and say that the banks cannot gamble with our money in the derivatives market. But instead, what they did is say, well, you can go on playing in your casino, but the next time you get into trouble for a big derivatives bust, then we, the taxpayers, are not going to bail you out. So you're on your own. So then the question is, where are they going to get the money? And the new template is called bail-in. We saw it in Cyprus, where two big banks went bankrupt. And before the Troika, the IMF, the EC, and the ECB would lend Cyprus more money, they were required to confiscate some of the deposits of some percentage of the deposits of all the depositors. Well, they took to the streets and they protested. So in the end, they agreed to only take the uninsured depositors. That would be everything over 100,000 euros, or in the US, it would be everything over $250,000. But they took a big chunk, I think like 60%, and just turned deposits into capital. It's like a debt for equity swap. Instead of having an IOU from the bank, you now have stock in the bank. Stock in a bankrupt bank.
Yeah.
So at the time, it looked like Cyprus was just, you know, it's sort of an emergency that they had to do a one-off in this one little island. But since then, it's become evident that it's actually a template that has been imposed globally by the Financial Stability Board, which is housed in Basel, Switzerland, in the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, and the G20 countries all agreed to be bound by the rules imposed by the Financial Stability Board. It used to be called the Financial Stability Forum, and it was only advisory. But now their rules, we have agreed to be bound by them. It should have been a treaty, and it should have been approved by Congress, et cetera, but they didn't do that. It was a handshake. Obama was there with everybody else, and they all shook hands on it. And now we have to do this bail-in template. Like if J.P. Morgan or Bank of America gets in derivatives trouble, they both have over $70 trillion in derivatives, and they have over $1 trillion in deposits. So they will, no doubt, be taking our deposits. And they can do this because legally, when you put your money in the bank owns the money, and all you have is an IOU. So you are a creditor of the bank. It's not your money once you put it in the bank.
Was that always so?
It's been so since the middle of the 19th century when there were some lawsuits where that was decided. Well, before that, it was the depositor's money, and so they were always kind of hovering over the banker and worrying about where the banker was making loans, like, oh, that looks risky, et cetera. And so the judge agreed that the banker couldn't run his business that way, so the judge said, well, we'll just say it's the banker's money, and the banker owes you the money, and they must pay up on demand. So you have an IOU on demand. So the next time we have a big derivatives bust, the derivatives pyramid is now up to, depending on who you read, it's somewhere between 700 trillion and 1.5 quadrillion. And the derivatives claims, according to the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, have super priority in bankruptcy. So that means that they will go before everybody else and they get their full claim before the rest of the pot is divided up. And that includes not just our private deposits, but public deposits. Most politicians will say, well, we're a secured creditor, so we go ahead of everybody else. Well, you go ahead of all the other unsecured creditors, but you're behind the derivatives players in line. So the public money could get wiped out too. And the last bailout was $700 billion, and the FDIC fund only has $32 billion in it. So they're not going to have enough to cover the small depositors either. So there's another way to do it, and both for the safety of our deposits, both public and private, and because we want access to this, the bankers' club. We want a seat at the table where we too, we the municipal government, would like to be able to borrow at 0.25%. I mean, why is it that Wall Street banks can borrow from each other for almost nothing, and governments have to borrow at 5% or 8%, and they have to worry about interest rate swaps and credit default swaps and rating agencies and the bond vigilantes, et cetera. I mean, there's all this pressure and difficulty getting money. The original public bank was established in the colony of Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's time. The other colonies, they all like issued their own money. That was their source of money, was this paper scrip. But they did tend to sometimes over-issue money. It was easier to issue it than to pull it back in taxes. So they did tend to have too much money out there. But in Pennsylvania, they came up with this model that was sustainable because most of the money was lent to the farmers. So they would print a certain amount of money, spend it into the economy. Let's say they printed $105, if you were using dollars, lend $100 at 5%, spend $5 on roads and bridges and whatever else you do for as a government, and then you'll have $105 out there, which will circulate in the economy, and that's enough to pay off principal and interest. It all comes back as principal and interest, and then you can lend the 100, spend the 5 all over again, comes back as principal and interest. So it's a sustainable system because, first of all, you issued a little extra that wasn't part of the debt system. And second of all, it comes back to the public, which then spends it again. So that was the model, and it worked while they had that model in place. They had no inflation, they had no public debt, and there's something else they didn't have. No taxes, that's right. They did it in place of taxes. That would actually work today. You could get rid of taxes, get rid of income taxes, by having the government own the bank. Let's say banking was a public utility, credit was a public utility. I did these figures in 2011. Total U.S. personal income tax that year was $1.1 trillion. Interest collected by U.S. banks was $725 billion. And interest paid on the federal debt was $454 billion. So assume that we had always been borrowing from our own bank, so we didn't have to pay interest, or we got the interest back. If you add those two things together, it comes out to more than $1.1 trillion. So we could have been income tax free if we owned the bank. If you own the bank, it's a big moneymaker for the government. It turns out that 35 to 40% of everything we buy goes to interest. This is according to Margaret Kennedy, who is a German researcher who got her figures from the Bundesbank. So that was actually German figures, but it's probably comparable. And 29% of business profits goes to the financial industry. So that's all something that we could recapture if we own the bank. For public projects, on average, interest is 40% of the cost of public projects. For things like public housing, it's 77%. But if you average it all together, it comes out to 40%. And these are the worst. We're seeing these today, these capital appreciation bonds, where there's no interest paid, and they go for 40 years. But in 40 years, there was one in San Diego where they will owe 10 times the principal. So that's 1,000% interest. And because of that, and because that was so outrageous, Jerry Brown, there was a bill that passed which said that now they can only make them be 4 times the principal. But even so, that's a horrible thing. So there were 400 school districts and other agencies that borrowed $9 billion that will cost taxpayers $35 billion over the next 40 years.
Ellen, we have one of those here in Willits.
Yeah, that's being left to the children and the grandchildren. So in California, if we owned the bank, if we had been borrowing from our own bank, we could have saved $70 billion. Well, the general obligation and revenue bonds in 2010 were $158 billion, of which $70 billion was interest. So you could have saved all that if you were borrowing from your own state-owned bank. In fact, arguably, if the federal government were borrowing, if it borrowed the entire debt from the Federal Reserve, which I think is actually a good idea. I mean, everybody freaks out on the idea that the Federal Reserve is buying up all the government debt, but what they do is they rebate the interest to the Treasury. So actually the cheapest way we can fund our federal debt is through the Federal Reserve. They didn't want to rebate the interest, but in the 1960s, Wright Patman tried to get them nationalized, and to avoid that, they agreed to return their profits to the Treasury. In France, this was done by Bernard Lyotard in a book called Money and Sustainability. In France, since 1979, their debt is equal to the amount of interest they have paid since 1979. So if they had not had to pay interest all that time, if they'd been borrowing from their own central bank, which issued the money directly, they would have no federal debt today. And that might be true for us. I added up all the, on the website of the, I think it was the Treasury's website, they gave how much interest we had paid each year for the last 24 years. So I added those all up and it came out to, $8 trillion out of a $15 trillion debt was interest. So that's more than half. And if you go all the way back to the beginning, it might have been, we've had a federal debt ever since, it hasn't been paid off since 1835. So if you go all the way back, it might arguably have been the whole debt. In order to save the banks, after 2008, the Federal Reserve dropped the prime rate to 0.25%, so really low. But the people did not get the benefit of that. The mortgage rates didn't go down nearly to the extent that the interest rate did. So how can we, the people, get a seat at the table, join the banking club, by owning a bank ourselves? There's only one state that does this, North Dakota. You've probably heard about it. It's also the only state that totally escaped the credit crisis. They have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate on loans, the lowest foreclosure rate, and they have no public debt or state debt at all. They set up their bank in 1919 when the farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers under conditions similar to what we have going on today. At that time, it was a Rockefeller cartel where there was the Rockefeller Bank and the Rockefeller Railroad and the Rockefeller Granary were all one cartel. And when the farmers realized they were Swedish and Norwegian and they barely spoke English, there's a movie on this, and they were very, weren't going to have anything to do with any kind of movement that sounded socialist. But when they realized that they were losing their farms unfairly, that the granary wasn't taking grain that was good, there was an actual effort to get their farms, then they banded together, formed the Nonpartisan League, making it clear that this was not left or right, it wasn't a partisan thing, it was all about sovereignty, that they wanted to keep their money in the state for their own purposes and recycle it for themselves. The model is that all their revenues, the state revenues by law, go into the Bank of North Dakota, and it's virtually the only depositor. They have a few individual depositors, but it's not very convenient to use that bank for your bank because you have to virtually live right there. They don't have any ATMs. They only have one building. So they're not really trying to make it easy for the customers, the individual customers, but they thought, well, it's a state bank. We should probably offer that. So they did. And their capital, originally they got their capital from a bond issue, but they've set it up as North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. So it's set up as a DBA of the state, which means technically all of the assets of the bank are the assets of the state. So when the Bank for International Settlements, the Basel Accords, when they try to say, well, you need more capital, they'll say, no, we're fully capitalized. We've got all the capital that's in the state is ours. They don't need to do bond issues for their infrastructure, et cetera. They can just do a loan. So they do a loan from the bank, no fees. They don't need like these interest rate swaps, et cetera, that the thing that ruined Detroit, for example, and many other cities. It's just a straight loan and they owe it to themselves. So either you could say they get the interest back or they don't pay interest anyway. It's basically interest free. Among other things, they paid a dividend in the last decade of $300 million. and they have a population that I think I figured was 7 times the population of Mendocino County. So it's a pretty small state. It's 1/14 the size of LA County, which is where I live. So that's a pretty good return for a small state. That goes back to the state, to the Treasury. I think lately they've kept some, I mean, most of it goes back to the state, but they've kept some for their own capitalization. I guess the state didn't need it. Well, I read they had all this extra and they couldn't decide. And they said, now, should we lower taxes or should we add more services? I mean, they must be the only state that's in that position.
That was the first part of a one-hour talk by Ellen Brown, president of the Public Banking Institute. She describes the operation of the Bank of North Dakota, a state-owned public bank going strong since 1919. Globally, 40% of banks are publicly owned. In the U.S., there's only one so far. And Ellen Brown is inspiring counties and even states to weigh the advantages and set up their own public banks. Come back when TUC Radio returns and Ellen Brown explains why the Bank of North Dakota has no incentive to speculate, how they managed to build up a huge capital base in a state with a small population, and how the bank funds public works by loans instead of expensive bond issues. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts. Follow Ellen Brown on the Public Banking website at publicbankinginstitute.org. You can get information on how to order a CD or a DVD of this talk by Ellen Brown by going to our secure website, tucradio.org, or by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org or 707-463-2654 for more information. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.